tonight on Arena. In movies, it's Bill and Ted Face the Music, The Devil All the Time and Nocturnal. And in theatre, it's Druid Gregory, all of them up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we'll start with the movie reviews. First up, it's the long-awaited return of William S. Preston Esquire and Theodore Logan, otherwise known as Bill and Ted Dudes, brought to the screen once more by Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter, this time as middle-aged saviours of humanity. In their latest incarnation, Bill and Ted Face the Music. The Devil All the Time is an American psychological thriller based on the novel by Donald Ray Pollock, directed by Antonio Campos. Billed as a battle between good and evil and set in America's Christian heartland. Finally, Nocturnal, from director Natalie Bianchieri, examines the relationship between a teenage schoolgirl, Laurie, and her secret friendship with an older man, Michael Pope. Cara O'Doherty have been looking at the films for us, and Michael is here with me in studio. Cara joining us on the line. Most excellent dudes, good to have you here.
We're just going to keep saying dude for this whole review, aren't we?
Well yes, only when you say bodacious.
Yeah, the stakes have never been higher, really. All of reality, not just the world and not just the fate of the human race, it's all of reality is collapsing in on itself. And as you said, Bill S. Preston, Bill S. Preston Esquire and Ted Theodore Logan, they haven't fulfilled their rock and roll destiny, which was to write the song that's going to save humanity. And now they're middle-aged and they got daughters and they get visited from the future by Kristen Schaal. Yeah. And she says that there's a very limited amount of time to save the universe and they have to write the song. And so their bright idea is to go into the future and meet their future selves.
Right. Okay.
We're getting into tennis territory here.
I was going to say, we're already going down a rabbit hole. But Cara, I suppose Michael has done the best to give us the kind of the premise of the new Bill and Ted movie. The premise isn't that important. The big thing is really, isn't it? Bill and Ted are back.
Oh, Michael did give a most excellent intro to the film there, I have to say. But yes, they are back. Did we need to see them come back? Who knows? But they have come back in the craziest of all years, trying to save humanity. I don't know, is that somewhat a coincidence, the timing? I don't know. Maybe Bill and Ted is exactly what we need right now.
I think humanity has needed saving for a long time, not just right now. But I suppose the original character of Rufus, played by George Carlin, the American comedian and agitator, his absence, he died obviously since the making of the last movie, his absence, that was a difficult task to get around that, Cara, really, wasn't it?
It was. So they've introduced Kristen Schaal and she's playing his daughter, who's called Kelly, who's actually George Carlin's real life daughter is Kelly. So it's a nice little nod there. And they bring him back. There's a lovely moment where they go to the future and the famous telephone box is sitting there like a little museum in the future. And the character of Rufus sort of steps out like a hologram and tells a little bit of the backstory. And it's nice. There's lovely little nods there. Right. And the character of Kelly, as she tries to guide the boys into the future, has nice little moments talking about Rufus.
Lovely that it is father-daughter in real life that she gets to do that on screen. Let's listen to the moment it is the moment when she first appears, when Kelly first appears to Bill and Ted.
Greetings, my excellent friends.
Do we know you?
I'm Kelly.
Wait, you're Rufus's daughter.
I am, and I've been wanting to meet you my whole life.
It must be very disappointing.
Not at all. We have a problem, gentlemen. Potentially a very serious problem.
About the music?
About the music. They just want to talk to you.
Dude, I got a very bad feeling about this. It'll be fine, Ted. They totally love us in the future, dude.
Dude, our dads are totally in trouble. I feel so bad for them. They've been doing this on their own for the longest time.
Yeah, I wish there was some way we could help them out, you know?
Yeah. But how?
Well, they do say you turn into your parents eventually. And the two voices we heard at the end of that clip from Bill and Ted Face the Music were Samara Weaving and Bridget Lundy, who play Thea and Billy, the daughters of Bill and Ted. And of course, before that, Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves as Bill and Ted. Kelly, played by Kristen Schaal in that scene from the latest version of Bill and Ted. I guess by bringing in the daughters like this, are they exactly? Are they just, you know, younger female versions of Bill and Ted?
I think they made a wise decision because, I mean, Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves are getting on there, and in particular, Keanu Reeves does look like he's been starring in action film, or really kind of carries himself like he's been starring in action films for the last 30 years, because he does look pretty tired and pretty worn out. And I think, even though it's short, 90 minutes, I think having them kind of run around on their own adventures kind of might have been a bit pushing it. So I think introducing these two young actors is a really nice touch. They're really, really funny, and they honestly might and should get their own movie out of this, because they are really charming. They actually have the charm that you would have got from Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves in 1989 for Excellent Adventure.
So, I mean, you've been very kind when you say it's a very good idea. Is that what's actually going on here, Cara, do you think? Are they actually setting up further sequels, or maybe even a television series to feature the two young actresses?
To be cynical, I would be very surprised if that wasn't in the intention behind it. The clever thing that I really like is, God bless them, Bill and Ted are so kind and funny, but they've never really had the smarts. And the daughters have, they've inherited the love of music. They have that crazy use of resplendent phrases and all that. But they're that bit smarter, which I think is quite clever to go down. And I they would make a good spin-off.
Yeah, Bill and Ted are going to get lots of help from musicians from the past, very talented musicians from the past.
A couple of names pop up: Jimi Hendrix, Louis Armstrong, Mozart, I believe, is in there, and also more contemporary, Kid Cudi is in there, and Kid Cudi's only job is to deliver techno babble in a very Christopher Nolan Star Trek type way. So he's just he has all this mega sci-fi jargon to deliver. It's really, really funny. It is that kind of that feeling from the first two, where they do kind of pick up the different historical figures from their historical times, and then it all kind of goes off in this kind of sweet natured adventure.
And Death is here once again, played by William Sadler. This clip features the two guys discovering him playing hopscotch by himself.
Yes, well, best 75 out of anyone.
Is he playing hopscotch by himself? He looks miserable, dude.
Yes!
Dude, he's cheating.
Yes!
Let's go, dude.
Good luck, Dads.
Be sweet.
Okay. Hey, Death. If it isn't the Wild Stallions. Have you come to sue me again?
No, Death. Not at all.
We just need to talk to you, Death.
Talk to the hand.
Talk to the hand. William Sadler there as Death, Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves in a scene from Bill and Ted Face the Music. The director here is Dean Parasot, and the writers, the original Bill and Ted writers, Chris Matheson and Ed Solomon. Wise move there. Does it work? Did you get any laughs, dude?
I think Cara might have kind of alluded to it there. It's a really fun movie, and that's just about enough right now. It's short, it's punchy, it's really, really sweet. It's actually quite moving when we meet really, really old deathbed Bill and Ted, not to give anything away. Mm. But it is really sweet and it's really funny. I mean, all the gags don't land, but you know, when it kind of has
enough to
enough really do, and that's kind of all I wanted. And it's short, 90 minutes. It's really good fun.
And what are you saying, stars wise?
I'll give it 3 out of 5. That's a good natured 3 out of 5.
A good natured 3 out of 5. So most excellent or most bogus for you, Cara?
Not excellent, not bogus either. I'll go with a 3. I think that it is, like Michael says, it's funny, it's sweet, there's a lot of charm there, but it doesn't always land. And I wonder what first-time viewers will make of these two. Yeah. I wonder if you do need that kind of 30-year-old attachment to really appreciate Bill and Ted.
Yeah, I was wondering whether some younger listeners might be thinking, why are they all saying dudes to each other? Well, there you go. Go and see Bill. Well, watch Bill and Ted. They're excellent adventures to find out, and you'll know why we're using dude and bodacious, etc. Totally different tone altogether in our second film this evening, spanning the time between World War II and the Vietnam War. The Devil All the Time, set in the backwoods of Ohio. An unholy preacher, a twisted couple, a crooked sheriff, converge around a young orphan as he fights the evil forces that threaten him and his surrogate family. The film is directed by Antonio Campos, stars an impressive ensemble cast including Tom Holland, Robert Pattinson, Bill Skarsgård, Mia Wasikowska, several several others as well. Rather than getting you to give us the very beginning of the film, Cara, could you take us to the point where we're with the kind of the teenage Arvin, who at this point is living with his grandmother and his granduncle and his stepsister? Where are we at? What's the situation, the setup there? Because that's really when the film gets going for me.
So his stepsister, Lenora, is deeply religious. She's very shy, she's very quiet, a little bit odd. And she is being relentlessly bullied by the school nasties. And Arvin was raised in anger. And he beats the life out of the bullies. He completely obliterates them. And he believes this is the right thing to do. And things get more complicated when a new preacher arrives in the town. And let's just say his beliefs aren't exactly wholly religious.
No.
And he takes a liking to the young Lenora.
And she's very, very, I suppose, vulnerable in the situation that she finds herself in. He's raised in anger was the way that Cara put it there, Michael. He has had a difficult childhood.
Yeah, well, I mean, with his father, played by Bill Skarsgård, Willard, he comes back from World War II and he's shell-shocked and he's seen things that he wished he hadn't, and he's lost his faith. So in meeting Arvin's mother, Charlotte, they fall in love and everything seems to be right in Knockham Stiff. But... you know, things kind of rear the head down.
Well, she gets ill. I don't think we're giving anything away to say she gets ill, and there are real problems in the family.
But
as
also,
in that
first half of the film, characters who come into it later on are introduced, including Jason Clarke and Riley Keough, as a pair of, I guess you could say, serial killers. Not really. I'm not sure if that's giving too much away.
Yeah, well, let's hold off on the pair of them, because I want to just concentrate on the family dynamic that is where we find ourselves for most of the film, I think. And this is a point between the Arvin character, played by Tom Holland, and Leonora, the stepsister, stepbrother, Leonora, played by Eliza Scanlon. He's just come back from dealing with the bullies in the playground, and he's having a chat with her in the car. Oh, you'll hear the voice of the narrator as well here, who's the actual writer of the novel, Donald Ray Pollock.
No matter what the weather was, Lenora would visit her mother's grave after school. Some days she would even read the Bible out loud and imagine her mother was listening. And though he wasn't one for praying, Arvin would often drive her and keep her company.
Arvin, was it sad you didn't end up in the hospital?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of no good sons of bitches out there.
My Lord, Arvin, you've been saying that almost since the day I met you.
Yeah, well, that's because it's true.
Well, maybe you should try praying for him then. Would that hurt, huh?
You already do enough for all of us. Where's it doing you much good, huh? You know what would do you good? To not be wandering behind school by your own self like I told you.
Arvin, played by Tom Holland, and Lenora, played by Eliza Scanlon, in that clip from The Devil All the Time. It really exemplifies for me part of the problem with this. On radio, it's great to have the voiceover narration because it sets up the clip for you perfectly.
Yeah.
But on screen, it's often just telling us what we're looking at.
It's funny. Don't get me wrong. I like voiceover when it enhances a film and kind of enriches it. But when it's just basically offering mind reading the characters, like, I mean, it works great in stuff like Goodfellas and, you know, The Assassination of Jesse James. But we're kind of in Ad Astra territory here. I don't know if you remember that film from a couple of years ago. It explains the actions and the events. It's more engaging to interpret it for yourself. Especially there's the scene where Riley Keough is kind of debating whether or not to take matters into her own hands and kind of separate herself from Jason Clarke's character. And
so we should explain.
Yes, we should explain.
Riley Keough is and just they're playing this kind. They're the kind of Bonnie and Clyde type of scenario.
Yeah, they're kind of outliers in the story itself. You're kind of not really sure how it's going to tie into the rest of it until maybe the last third. But you know, she's kind of having her doubts about what they're up to because they are actually out killing people and taking pictures of them. But what happens is she's kind of having her doubts, and it's at that moment she decided she thought about turning the gun on him herself, and we don't need that explained. It's far more enjoyable for the viewer, I find, to be able to put the pieces together yourself.
Did the voiceover grate on you in that respect, Cara?
No, and actually I've quite the opposite. Normally I find them quite trying, but it's partly to do with Pollock's really, his voice is just this deep resonating thing. Mm. And I think he becomes quite a character in it. And I had this vision of an old boy sitting in a rocking chair outside a rundown house telling the story years after it's happened. And I thought it really gave this extra edge to it, actually, which is quite different to Michael's take on it there.
Yeah, well, I wondered though about this, the omniscient nature, because it's the novelist himself, and, you know, should you let a novelist near a screenplay, is a debate for another day, perhaps. But, you know, do we need somebody who knows everything telling us that? I was hoping it would turn out to be one of the characters, but it doesn't. I'm still asking you that, Cara, sorry.
I think there's so many threads in this that it just pulls it together bit by bit. You can't really take your eye off the ball on this one because every tiny thread has a consequence later on. And I just think he brought a kind of an unusual depth to it. So I would definitely, I'd keep him there.
Yes, you definitely enjoyed that presence. Now, you've touched on one of the threads, Michael, in that we have the, I'm calling them Bonnie and Clyde, it's not quite right. They're basically taking photographs, a kind of soft porn, maybe snuff aspect to what they're doing.
Post-coital and post-mortem.
Yeah, fairly nasty stuff. There's also a corrupt cop in there, and we have two, including Robert Pattinson, two preachers who appear along the way at different times. There's an awful lot going on here. It's obviously a big sprawling novel, which if you're reading over a period of a couple of weeks, you'd follow all those threads easily. Yeah, 2 hours of a film, do you get lost?
Two and a bit hours.
Yeah.
Out of the two performances, the lesser known actor would be Harry Melling, a.k.a. Dudley Dursley from the Harry Potter films. Now, he's gone for full fire and brimstone, sweaty, kind of, zealous preacher mode. He's even at one point pours spiders on his face to prove that to the big man that he's not scared.
Yeah, he
of
got over his
anymore.
Fear of spiders.
Whereas Pattinson is definitely going for something a lot different. He's almost comically mean-spirited at the start. And then he's definitely going to underplay it. He's not going fire and brimstone. He's going more for kind of... he's more sinister
an insidious sinister quality.
He doesn't want to.
Pattinson
has natural charisma to burn, but he's very much underplaying that. He's not interested in that. He just basically wants to kind of snarl and slither rather than kind of thump the Bible and scream about hell and heaven.
I have a funny feeling. I think you did too, Michael. You found that number of threads a little bit too many, perhaps one or two too many.
I thought when they converged, it didn't really thematically make sense. No.
I have a feeling, given what you said, Cara, about the voiceover narration and how you wanted it there, that the threads did knit together well for you, and that it did all come together. Am I right?
It did. It surprised me when it started. I wasn't really sure. I was thinking, how is this actually going to play out? But I think that it played together very nicely. It is still a bit too long. It could have been trimmed. But I think now I think it weaves into a really kind of strong nail biter. And I would like to complain to Michael for reminding me about that spider thing because I had to forget it.
They were CGI spiders, but it was fine.
It doesn't matter. Give a warning about that.
Yeah, if you listen to the zealous preacher, of course, the Holy Spirit will help you over the fear of the spiders.
Until he gets bitten in the face by a giant spider, which actually happens.
Slight problem in terms of that. The Coen brothers were actually, that's who you wanted to see making this film rather than Antonio Campos.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of work that I wish that they were adapting and interpreting for us. Like, it's got that eye for, their eye for kind of dark humour and kind of even darker humanity. Would be great. I mean, there's a certain line in it that Sebastian Stan's kind of corrupt sheriff delivers. He says, "Some people were born just so they could be buried," and that screams Joel and Ethan. You know, that's kind of what I wanted from the film, and I kind of got just kind of an average.
I presume the Campos are related to it because there's a Paolo Campos involved in the screenwriting, so I presume Antonio and Paolo are either brothers or cousins or whatever. So stars from you first of all on this one, Cara. I think you enjoyed it quite a bit, in fact.
I did, yeah. Performance-wise as well, it's just so great. And a cast that strong, it's hard to pick anyone, but Tom Holland really stands out. But I'm going to go with 4 stars on it. I had no nails left by the end of it, but it was worth it.
All right. And what are you saying overall, Michael?
There's entertainment to be had, but it's just a bit dreary and melodramatic and maybe kind of undercooked for me. 2 out of 5.
2 out of 5. Okay. Let us move on then. The Devil All the Time is the name of that second movie that we've been speaking about. Move on to our final movie this evening, Nocturnal Story of a 16, 17-year-old girl from Ireland who relocates to Yorkshire, becomes a bit of an outsider at her new school, but she strikes up a friendship with an older man, a painter, decorator. Cara, Initially, I found this quite difficult to kind of even see what was going on. It was quite grainy and murky. Just kind of give us the premise on how quickly we set into this friendship stroke relationship between the older man and the younger girl.
It's a dark, miserable winter in Yorkshire, and 33-year-old Peter, played by Cosmo Jarvis, he's a painter-decorator. He's monosyllabic, a bit of a loner, and he's painting a sports club when he spots the 17-year-old Laurie. And he's instantly kind of taken by her. We don't know what it is at first. She calls him out for staring, but instead of kind of shying away, she's kind of intrigued as to why this older man is interested in her, and instead of running very fast, they strike up a very strange friendship.
Yeah, because initially when I saw that, you know, because he really does stare at her as she's running on the racing track in a kind of an almost leery type of way. I was very uncomfortable watching it initially,
yeah.
Michael.
I think there's two reasons why you were saying it's very jarring, the opening 15, 20 minutes. It's kind of shot in this 4.3 aspect ratio, which is basically the old television. It feels just like a square frame. So it's very claustrophobic anyway. But it barely gives us a look at Pete for the first 15, 20 minutes. I don't think we see his face.
The Cosmo Jarvis character.
Yeah, Cosmo Jarvis. We don't really see him. He's kind of, and like you said, he's mumbling away, and he's this kind of hulking presence. And then you can kind of see that he spots Laurie, and you don't know. Honestly, I was really creeped out, and I felt like I was like, this cannot be going where I think it's going. And I don't know if it's giving too much away, but it's actually not really that good. It's more about friendship and connection.
This connection and specifics of a relationship.
So it's maybe best for the first 15, 20 minutes that we don't actually hear everything he's saying, or even get to know this guy, because when we actually do kind of understand what's going on with him, it's in full close-up on his face, and it's actually quite rewarding already.
Yeah, even it begins to brighten up as well, which is great. Happy you begin
to
see things.
The Yorkshire, the coast, is not something I've actually seen on film much. It is quite beautiful.
Looks lovely, Let's listen to a clip from early on in the film, and Laurie, played here by Lauren Coe, a young Irish actor, in fact, is in the middle of her physical education class, running on the track with her classmates, and there's a bully in the midst of it all, Ella Grace Gregoire, and Annie's boyfriend, Liam, joins in the midst of all of this, and there's a bit of harsh language as they tear strips out of each other.
Oi, Laurie, Danny's on his way. You know Danny, don't you? Track champion.
This is where you train with the track team.
No other track in this shithole, is there?
What, Dublin's fucking London, is it?
Yeah, compared to here.
Well, why don't you go back then?
Maybe I will.
Gorgeous.
God, Miss A is going to have a fit if she's Asian.
Going to town tonight? We're heading down the YUX.
No, I can't. It's Angel 17.
Oh, come on.
Don't. Laurie's getting jealous. We were scared the other night when you were calling.
So there we go. Lauren Coe, one of the main voices that you heard in the midst of that, playing the character of Laurie in Nocturnal. You also heard Ella Grace Gregoire. She's quite definitely from Dublin, and they set that up in the character, but it takes a while to kind of work out why we're hearing the Irish accent, or it did for me anyway. Maybe I was a bit slow on this one, Michael.
I was to say, is that kind of mumblecore situation going on with the first 20, 25 minutes? Yeah, I mean, initially the accent doesn't really matter. You know, you just kind of assume that you kind of get the impression straight away that she is living with her mother, and and they're estranged, and they don't really know each other that well, which is why she is not as creeped out as we think she should be by Pete's, I don't want to say advances, but definitely his obsessive glances.
His
interest in to spend time with her more than anything else. Yeah, I think that's, she plays it very well, because he's obviously a really sullen, sulken presence. He's a melancholic guy, but she's a 16-year-old girl, and she's not really that interested in that side of him. She just wants to maybe have a beer, smoke some cigarettes, run around the music arcades and stuff, you know?
Yeah, I wondered, did you find it credible that she would just say, oh yeah, you know, he says, let's go for an ice cream at one point along the way, and she says, oh no. Actually, I think I have that clip here. I do have the clip where she actually sets up about how they might go out on a little date together. Cosmo Jarvis in the part of Pete, Lauren Coe in the part of Laurie, and again, a bit of language involved in this clip.
You're a creepy fuck. You've got balls.
Look, Laurie's trying to get us a boyfriend.
Still trying to get me in your car?
I could move straight to the blow to the head. Stick in a barrel of hydrochloric acid.
What's your name?
Pete. What's yours?
Like Peter Sutcliffe.
Oh yeah, we'll be named after him.
My name's Rose West. Can I have a cigarette?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Maybe we could go for an ice cream or something.
What, am I 12? 11 p.m. at the arcade. Bring the car, yeah? And the acid.
Yeah, bang in.
There we go. Cosmo Jarvis as Pete and Lauren Coe as Laurie in a scene there from Nocturnal. Setting up a date. Now, she's a teenager. I think her mother actually says she's 17 at a certain stage along the way, and he's in his 30s. I think he tells us he's 33. Cara, we've been talking here about a sense of discomfort around it. Did you have a sense of discomfort around the relationship, and was it believable that, you know, that would happen so quickly after kind of first meeting each other?
Well, she's 17. She's recently transplanted from Dublin to Yorkshire. She's annoyed at her mum. She can't settle in. She wants to go back to Dublin, and her friends are bullying her. And this older guy kind of makes advances. So I think probably initially she did it just to show the bullies that she could make friends with them. But I think there's a combination of she's still trying to get back at her mum and annoy her. But then she genuinely does develop some sort of feelings for him. So, I can see how it could happen. But it is uncomfortable, and it's hard to watch because you just don't know what's happening. But there's a moment where he refuses her advances, and then you really start to think, what is going on here? What is his interest in her if it isn't to get her into bed? So yeah. it keeps you guessing.
And the other side of it is, Michael has also mentioned this, and I mentioned this idea that as the film goes on, it does brighten up and you get to see more of the characters, you find out more about the characters. Did that feel like a different film, or did the two work very well opposite each other for you, Cara?
It worked for me. I thought that it just this lightening up. He's such a big hulking brute, but he becomes lighter. He starts to play. He talks a little bit more. He's never going to win an award for a conversation, but he opens up. I think the cinematographer, I think he's called Michael Dymock, he does this amazing job of lighting up these really dark, drab areas. Like, he somehow turns a factory setting into something quite magical. So it sort of plays into this idea of what is going on here. And it's shedding some light as the story unfolds.
Yeah, I suppose some of that is down to the director as well, for sure, Nathalie Biancheri. And Cosmo Jarvis, we saw him in Cam with Horses.
Well, I didn't see that. Yeah, Cam with Horses.
He's in a phenomenal kind of presence, hasn't he?
Initially, the way he was acting is kind of Pete's kind of, he's wounded and he's kind of sullen and he's definitely repressed in many ways. And I remember thinking to myself, is this a Tom Hardy I'm seeing here now? Is that the energy I'm getting from this? But as it went on, I started to realize that what I'm actually thinking of is Marlon Brando. And I know that might sound like hyperbole, but I genuinely saw that kind of hulking, like Cara was saying, that hulking, mumbling, sulking charisma, but with real like light behind the eyes and a real energy. This guy, he's an actor musician, and I had to look at his Wikipedia page, which is actually all about him being a musician. I don't think he doesn't really sound that interested in acting, but I think this guy has everything. Yeah, I really do.
And he was phenomenal in Cam with Horses, and I remember the Irish accent in that. It was just Maeve Agler spoke to me about the film at the time, and she said he was on set all the time, and he made a phone call to her after the event in his own accent, and she didn't know who it was. So Cosmo Jarvis is one thing. What about Lauren Coe? She strikes me as someone who has a very bright future ahead of her as well, Cara.
Definitely, she's very strong, and I think it's a hard line to balance playing a teenager. You can cross over into kind of annoying territory, but she doesn't do that. She has that balance right, and she has that typical 17-year-old spark of thinking that 17 is actually a lot older than it really is, but really you're still just a kid. She certainly balanced that well. I think she's in her late 20s or her mid-20s, so she can certainly carry that well.
Stars from you, Cara.
Definitely with a 4, really strong. And I'm really fascinated to see what Biancheri does next. This is her first feature, so that's a strong one to have as your first outing.
And you saying, Michael?
Strong 4. It's a really beautiful film.
All right, strong 4 from you as well. That's Michael Pope and Cara O'Doherty speaking to us about Nocturnal, The Devil All the Time, and Bill and Ted Face the Music. Be excellent to each other, dudes. Druid Theatre Company is back doing what it does best, live theatre. The company is touring the west of Ireland with a set of plays written by Lady Augusta Gregory. Druid Gregory, as it is called, began last night with a short residency in the home of Lady Gregory, Coole Park, for 6 nights. Judy Murphy was there for Arena and she joins me now from Galway. Even just the thought, Judy, of heading out and seeing live theatre must have been exciting in and of itself. What was the kind of atmosphere as you arrived in Coole Park last night? Or was it last night you were there? Yes.
It was last night, Sean. Yeah, it opened last night. It was absolutely, to drive into Coole Park and to see all the people who were there for their ordinary evening walk, the regular people who go there walking, and then to be diverted off towards the tea rooms, or to be going down to the car park towards the tea rooms, which are around where the old stables are, and to see the crowds gathered and the lights, and it just beginning to get dark. It was just dusk, and the Druid banners up and little Druid awning. It was, and just people happy, happy to be out and anticipating an evening of theatre. It was lovely. Just even, we were a receptive audience, I guess, is what you can say, after a bit of a famine.
Yeah, there has been a famine, it would have to be said, in recent times. But the setting here, you weren't in a theatre, you were outdoors watching this, and you're going to see, isn't it, 6 plays in total over the space of the evening. What kind of aspect did the wonderful grounds in and around Coole Park, did they give to the fact that you were about to see plays by Lady Gregory herself?
Well, to me it was special. I love Coole Park anyway. I go there a lot, and I just think it's one of the most amazing places available on our doorstep. And to be there at night time, which I haven't been for stuff like this, to be there at night time and to be taken off down, there's so many paths and so many woodland areas, and most of them lead down to the lake, and the lake is the famous lake that Yeats wrote the poem about. And some of the action, the rising of the moon takes place quite close to the lake, and they incorporate the lake in the place. So, and they incorporate a lot of the old buildings, like the jail gate and the McDonough's wife, the buildings are incorporated for some of those. So it's really, really clever the way it's all done. And it's so beautifully lit. It's a really atmospheric evening. It's an experience, really.
Yeah. So you've touched on some of the plays that are there. The jail gate is as a mother and daughter-in-law arriving at the jail with a letter that they've received. The other play that you mentioned is McDonough's Wife. This is a piper. Is he going to be able to mourn his wife or not? And the Rising of the Moon, kind of almost a comedy aspect to the Rising of the Moon, isn't it? Three policemen posting wanted notices, offering £100 reward for an Irish rebel that has escaped prison. But I think it takes a kind of a comic twist on things.
The way she kind of explores Irish nationalism and the policemen and the divided loyalties and stuff like that. And, you know, so many Irish people joined the RIC and they did it for to make a living out of it. But it wasn't as simple as we would see it sometimes, of the way we're taught in history.
And Marie Mullen, is she Lady Gregory kind of leading you around? Because you're moving from space to space to see the different plays.
We are. And Marie is kind of, well, there's one part where it's Rory Nolan is doing it on a bicycle. and I don't want to give too much away for people who are going. And then Marie does and the policemen do. But sometimes it's mostly Marie, and she brings a kind of a regal presence to the whole thing as Lady Gregory. And then she sort of segues from that into the various parts she plays, because she plays, like everybody else, she plays
several roles.
And
I suppose the most famous are the best known of the plays of Lady Gregory's that's performed is by Lady Gregory and William Butler Yeats, Kathleen Ni Houlihan, and this is very much an exploration of Irish nationalism.
It is. And I suppose it's the one that is kind of the most highfalutin in terms of the language and the poeticness of the language. And you know, the question of Yeats and Gregory's input into that and who did what, and that was always kind of, or wasn't very widely known for a long time, that she wrote certainly the first 10 pages. But it's a really powerful, it's a play about nationalism. It's a play about Kathleen Ni Houlihan is Ireland and through the ages, and she beguiles kind of young men. And it's the line where Yeats subsequently said that, did words of mine send young men out to die? But she beguiles young men to go and regain and reclaim her 4 green fields. So there's a young man about to get married and his family have got the dowry. But as this is happening and as it all unfolds, we learn that the French ships are pulling into Killala. So it's 1798. Yeah. So it's a moment in history.
And again, that being played in an outdoor situation must add something enormous to it.
It did. And the set of that is quite, even though it's against a wall and it's quite simple in terms of the setting, but the lighting is beautiful. And again, it's just the little add-on, the touches that make it special. It's dark by the time that one is done. And even though last night was a stunningly lovely night, it gets cool. So anyone who's going, I'd say, layer up
and bring
your coat and definitely bring shoes and socks.
Yeah, I think when I was talking about The Rising of the Moon, I was mixing it up in my head with Hyacinth Halvey, which is another of there are five Lady Gregory plays being performed. And it's the one that is kind of more of a comic aspect to it.
The Rising of the Moon is comic as well. It is definitely comic. But I mean, there's a kind of an undertone to The Rising of the Moon that is, you know, she gets to serious things in some of the Hyacinth Halvey is just a kind of a romp.
Yeah.
And it's where they all go kind of completely hamming it up because the characters are one dimensional but it's a very enjoyable.
There's almost a Miles Nicopoline type of feel to the Hyacinth Halvey script, it struck me. The sixth play that's performed then is Tom Murphy and Nola Donoghue on the
Outside. Wasn't on last night.
So that wasn't part of last night's performance.
No.
Right.
No.
So that's a separate issue. So the five plays then, is it a lot to take in the five Lady Gregory plays? Is it a lot to take in one evening? Did it work for you, Judy?
It really worked for me. What was absolutely lovely was the energy of the cast and the people at the front of house. The whole thing just it worked so well together because we were being moved from place to place. They had to kind of keep control of us. We all had to be socially distanced. Most people were wearing masks for most of the time. We could take them off when we were seated, but most people kept them on. And it was just, I'm not sure these plays would work indoors in a conventional theatre setting.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that they're the best plays in the world, but they are a really interesting kind of little glimpse into a period in Irish history and to a woman as well who kind of created the language. Because she was a really avid folklore collector and she had a huge deal of, she grew to have a huge deal of sympathy for the local peasantry and the Irish peasantry and the kind of ideals of nationalism coming from a kind of an Anglo-Irish background.
Yeah, and did something similar to Singh in that she had her kind of what was referred to, I think, as the Kiltartan dialect, which was a kind of English-Irish or Hiberno-English that she kind of invented for her characters.
I do be telling you it was.
Well, thank you for telling me that.
But it, when you listen to it and you think of Singh, who followed her, and Martin McDonagh. Yeah. Oh my God, I mean, I keep thinking Martin McDonagh should be paying that woman's estate royalties because it's like the influence.
Yeah.
It's just percolated through Irish theatre.
What about the cast? I mean, a lot of Druid regulars here. Were there standout performances or moments from you from the cast?
Well, Marie Mullen is, and she really was, and again, a lot of work there last night for her. Mm. I liked Sarah Morris hugely. She played Mary Cashel in The Jail Gate.
She's the daughter-in-law that's going with Marie Mullen as the mother-in-law to the prison, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And both these women, they've received a letter and neither of them can read, and they have trekked over mountains and all referencing the areas around South Galway and North Clare, like East Clare, where Gregory would have drawn her stories from. I really loved her as Mrs. Delane in Hyacinth Halvey. And I also like Liam Heslin, and Marty Ray, I thought, of the Piper McDonagh, because that's a dark play. And it's a difficult play, and he's not a sympathetic character necessarily, but the whole sort of notion of the Piper as artist and maybe a bit feckless and in a time of grief, I thought he gave a very restrained performance in what could have been a bit of a, you know, it could have been a two-dimensional thing. Or a one-dimensional thing, sorry.
Obviously, Gary Hines doing the directing here. How did that fare for you and the other aspects of production, movement, music, etc.?
I thought it was beautifully done. And along the way, you got little surprises like Julie Feeney and Tim Doyle, who was the musician who played the pipes throughout the show regularly. And he also played, he's a multi-instrumentalist. He played guitar and concertina as well. But you're walking from one place to the other and suddenly you have Julie Feeney kind of appearing in robes and she's singing and she goes off into Mishraftry and Filla, and she kind of, because Lady Gregory was a huge advocate and supporter of the memory of Raftery and his poetry. So she kind of, her contribution is to acknowledge Lady Gregory's kind of link with him. So it was just, there were all these little strands and threads running through it. It was just an experience of something. It was a special experience.
Yeah, I think we're all going to have special experiences at this moment when we're getting back into seeing and experiencing live theatre. But this one seems to have stood on its own 2 feet even without that, I think you're saying, Julie.
Yeah, I think it did. I really do. I mean, we certainly were, as I say, a receptive audience. But, I mean, to pull this off and to do it in such a stylish and meaningful way, I thought, was very, very, very powerful.
Yeah, of course. And if you'd been disappointed, the disappointment would have been much bigger, you see. So being receptive has its disadvantages as well for the company. But it worked for you. That's clearly what you're saying. The six plays, or the five plays, rather, Druid Gregory, will be at Coole Park until September the 20th. Then they move to Clifton Arts Festival. 13 other venues, including Ballinasloe and Tuam, the actual setting for the Tom Murphy play, Glenamaddy, Kinvara, and many more, much more information to be found out on druid.ie. Judy Murphy, our reviewer this evening.
Till your eyes find me, I'm strong as my bones. Till then, only then, I am strong as my bones. Till your eyes find me, I'm strong as my bones. Till then, only then, I am strong as my bones. Till your eyes find me, I'm strong as my bones.
I like the sound of that. Birdsong. It's the current single from Emma Langford from her album Sowing Acorns. And the other voices that you heard in the midst of that single are those of Ruth Smith, Alma Kelleher, Sive, Jess Lean, Carrie Q and Niamh Farrell. I think there are others on there as well. Emma Langford has referred to them as her army of Manaw. And we'll be reviewing Emma's new album Sowing Acorns tomorrow night on the programme, along with new albums from Cults and OCs. Tomorrow evening, as part of Culture Night, six Irish-owned bars, restaurants and shops across Berlin will host a wide variety of Irish street photography that together will project a spectrum of real life in Ireland, from the pilgrimage of Croagh Patrick to the Trinity Ball, from inner-city Dubliners to West of Ireland horse markets and fisheries. This marks the first time Ireland's Culture Night will be celebrated abroad. And joining me now is Candice Gordon, a cultural officer based in the Irish Embassy in Berlin. I'll talk specifically about the exhibition in a minute, Candice, but maybe you tell me a little bit about your role. I believe you are the first of a number of cultural officers to have been appointed by the Department of Foreign Affairs. What exactly is your role?
I'm in my third week in the embassy, so I'm brand new to it. I'm the head of culture for the Berlin embassy, so that would span the whole of Germany. And what I can do to connect Irish artists and, you know, companies with German opportunities around Germany.
And I think part of your role as well is that this idea that perhaps there are very narrow ideas around what Irish culture is outside of this country, perhaps, cliched ideas of what constitutes Irishness. Are you battling against that, or is that part of your role to battle against that?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say battle against it. I think I'm really, really lucky because it's like everyone wants to talk to me. When I speak to people and say, okay, I'm with the Irish Embassy, everyone loves us, you know. Mm. So they love what we do, and what they know that we do tends to be more traditional. The Kelly family were very big in Germany in the 70s, and that left a very lasting impression, for example. So I don't think that's bad, because it's like, you know, it's helping us a lot here. At the same time, I think there's a lot of opportunity to expand on that and really show them, you know, how complex we are culturally.
Yeah, and which is part of what you're doing with this exhibition of photographs. Very interesting how it's actually being shown. People in Berlin will not be going to a gallery. They won't even have to go inside to see the pictures.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, this is sort of like necessity being the mother of invention. You know, I was trying to figure out a way to do something that's socially distanced. So the screens, they're on high definition, really big screens in the windows. So people can, I mean, firstly, people who don't know about the exhibition will happen upon it and see the photographs and then, you know, learn about it. And then also, you know, the attendees can go on a trail around Berlin. I mean, it's there's six locations very spread out around Berlin. So I thought as well, I mean, my idea for it is that it's also a sort of activity that people can do together while staying apart.
Yeah, so in some ways you're bringing culture night, really the way it would be celebrated in towns and cities around Ireland, people getting out onto the streets and doing things together, even though that'll be much more limited this year, obviously. You're bringing that idea to Berlin, that get out onto the streets and experience culture.
Yeah, well, Culture Night, I mean, it's like such a fabulous success, and it is a trail, really. You know, you're kind of exactly finding the different things and getting actively engaged by going to different places. So, yeah, this is like a exact imprint of that concept.
So you had to choose then. You have six different shop windows, bar windows, restaurant windows in which these high definition screens are placed. You had to choose, is it one photographer for each location, or did you just choose six and divide them up around all of the locations, if my question is clear?
So yeah, no, it is. It's one, so each location is dedicated to one artist. So there's a display that has the information about the artist, and then the screen that has their photographs on a slideshow. It's dedicated locations for each artist. So you'd go and say, okay, I want to see, you know, Eamon Doyle's, and you go over to Bad Fish in Friedrichshain, and then you want to see Birte Kaufmann in Miserloo in Prenzlauer Berg, you know, and you'd go and do the whole trail. So you actually have, we have trail cards where they can, like, people can go and get a stamp, and sort of it's gamified.
Right, so the idea is to get all six stamps, I guess.
Exactly.
The name Birte Kaufmann jumps out, and particularly the way that you say it with a nice German bloss, if I can put it that way. She's from Berlin. Does she have a connection with Ireland?
Yeah, so she actually spent 4 years living in Ireland with a family of travellers, and she documented that experience and she made a book about it. Mm. So, yeah, it's a fabulous book. Her work is fantastic. And, I mean, it's an example. It's not the only example, but it's an example of, I was really aiming of, you know, to try and have a really, wide spectrum of Irish culture represented.
Yeah, you also mentioned Eamon Doyle there. I'm just looking at one of the images from, I have one from Berta, which is a young traveller woman, I think, I would guess, lying back in a caravan. Very evocative picture indeed. But Eamon Doyle's, the one I'm looking at, is, it could be from any era. It almost looks like a Beckett tramp walking off, a man wearing a great coat and a bowler hat in amongst a flat complex in Dublin, I'm guessing.
Yeah. I mean, all of the photographers, what really struck me is how cinematic the images are. And, you know, basically, I could have taken any of the images. They're being used in the promotion. I mean, I'm going to be using, there's many in the promotion, because I'm sort of trying to basically give the photographers as big a platform as possible.
Tell me about Janet Lowe, because I'm looking at a picture here, a photograph here in front of me, a reproduction, and I'm thinking, is that Ireland bathed in sunshine, looking like some kind of Mediterranean holiday resort?
Yeah, so that's a great project by Janet Lowe called Life Imitating Art, where she took photographs of these locations. And I mean, for me, I grew up in Dublin. I just like instantly recognized them, even though. So she basically turned these photographs into something that is, you know, inspired by an Edward Hopper painting.
All right. Yeah, you can see that influence as I look at it then. So we've mentioned three there. We should mention the other three then as well. Kenneth O'Halloran, Laura Jean Zito, and Lorcan Finnegan make up your sextet.
Yeah.
Does each of the six photographers, are they really dealing with one aspect, if you like, of Irish culture, in the way that you said that Berta was dealing with traveller culture, for example, and perhaps Eamon dealing with more a kind of an urban type, Eamon Doyle with an urban culture?
Yeah, Lorcan is mainly focused on Dublin. Mm. And he actually had a book called Granny Fashion, if I remember correctly. And so he's really focusing on kind of characters and, again, just like very cinematic. I mean, Lorcan is a director and, you know, quite a successful director. He had a great film out this year called Vivarium, I should mention.
Oh, yes. We spoke to him about that, actually, that film. Yeah. Great film. Good fun.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, Kenneth O'Halloran, he has quite a mixture. So he has some from, you know, there's sets from like the horse market, from Croke Patrick, from the Trinity Ball. And I love seeing that mix across his exhibition.
Okay. And people can actually see the exhibition. It'll launch tomorrow online. They can watch it on or see it on irelandinframe.com. And thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Candace Gordon there. Cultural attaché, if that's the correct term, cultural officer with the Department of Foreign Affairs based in the Irish Embassy in Berlin. RTE will mark Culture Night tomorrow night, 2020, an evening and a range of special broadcasts, commissioned performances, live concerts happening across television, radio and online. You can find out full details, rte.ie/culture. That's our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Damien Chanel was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock.